The Victorian Community History Awards presentation ceremony for 2012 was held on 23rd of October in the Great Hall of the National Gallery of Victoria. It was a heartwarming celebration of community history attended by about 300 guests. The distinguished historian, Professor Richard Broome, himself a former prize winner for his book Aboriginal Victorians, gave the address. The event marked the second year of a constructive partnership between the Royal Historical Society Victoria and the Public Record Office Victoria that has given the History Award stability after a period of intense uncertainty. The definition of community history as covered by the competition is elusive, owing to the endless variety of entries. They may come from a community of place or a community of interest. I hope the types of entries received will become apparent later in this paper. Although many professional historians participate, contestants are mainly non-professionals who may have small grants but work primarily on a volunteer basis. The watchwords of the competition have been excellence, innovation, and community dimension. Now in its 14th year, the History Awards have revealed a vast reservoir of interest in community history. To the casual observer, the VCHA presentation event in 2012 appeared to be an established part of Melbourne's rich literary life. But the competition has had a precarious existence and was twice nearly extinguished. The History Awards originated in discussions in 1997 between Darryl Rogan, marketing manager at Information Victoria, and former ABC journalist John Henwood of Pegasus Communications, a company which numbered Information Victoria among its clients. Darryl argued that the proposed competition would stimulate community history and improve the then sagging image of the Kennett government, especially in regional districts. Joanne Duffy, then Director of Information Victoria and the Communications Branch of the Premier's Department, secured funding, and Information Victoria organised the competition until 2010. The first community history competition was held at Toongabie on Australia Day in 1998. Patrick Paddy Morgan, a senior lecturer at the Gippsland campus of Monash University, won the overall prize of $5,000 for his book, The Settling of Gippsland. Four category winners each received $1,000, and commendation certificates went to six other contestants. The categories were expanded to six the following year, namely print, collaborative, research, walks, exhibits, and multimedia. Various adjustments in 2012 included the addition of a small publication section to ease pressure on the highly competitive print category, and also a Young Historians Award designed for schools. The prize giving was held nearly every year from 2000 to 2011 at Queen's Hall, Parliament House. The palatial hall, with display of competition entries in elegant glass cabinets, dignified and elevated community history. Judy Madigan, MLA for Essendon, former Speaker of the House and history enthusiast, gave the government imprimatur to proceedings. Contestants flocked to the event from all over Victoria and exchanged ideas. Prize winners were given the chance to speak, making the event unpredictable and often emotional and theatrical. Sometimes the contestants themselves were the story. Thus Margaret Gardner and Val Heffernan from Hamilton jibbed and hugged one another on learning that their historic walks booklets had won a prize. Another two women, Annette O'Donoghue and Bev Hansen, were overcome when their Eagle Hawk and District Pioneer Register Volume 6 won the overall prize in 2008. It was the culmination of 17 years' work to document over 9,500 adults who lived on the goldfield before 1880. Then there was the sad absence in 2011 of prize winner Ron Hatley, a former lecturer in forestry at Creswick. Although disabled by spinal injury, he completed his significant book, The Victorian Bush, Its Original and Natural Condition, but died aged 63 before learning of his award, which was accepted by one of his sons. The RHSV has always appointed the judges for the Victorian Community History Awards, and among the first three was the historian we honour today, Professor Weston Bate. The other founding judges were Professor Alan Shaw and senior journalist at The Age, John Lay, who was well known for his column, Lay at Large. John was the heart and soul of the awards for about 10 years, and his unique writing style enlivened citations, which were used by winning contestants on dust jackets and for other publicity purposes. In 2003, John wrote that Vicky Fairfax, in her book, A Place Across the River, knitted together the many threads of the art centre's history and never dropped a stitch. There have been various permutations on the judging panel. Dr. John Hurst and I served for many years, and recently Dr. Peter Yule and Associate Professors Don Gibb and Don Garden have acted as judges. The total prize money of $11,000 available for the awards in 1999 remained the same for another 10 years. It is now $18,000 in total. The prize money is meagre when compared with the largesse of the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards, where a category winner scores $25,000 and the overall winner $100,000. But it is not money so much as recognition that community historians value. Community historians have for long suffered the ostracism of the metropolitan dailies and the disdain of the Australian Book Review, the main reviewing journal. They have relied for publicity on local media, the History Awards, and the RHSV with its sympathetic Victorian Historical Journal and Don Gibb's outstanding book reviews in History News. A small breakthrough occurred this year when Jason Steger's report on the VCHA prize winners in The Age marked the first coverage of the competition by a metropolitan daily. The VCHA has a distinctive egalitarian character. Every entry is retained by the RHSV, thus forever expanding the society's local history collection, the best in the state. The many commendations awarded counteract the winner-takes-all aspect of the big literary competitions. For several years, Information Victoria published a popular booklet, Victorian Tales, which contained extracts from nearly all entries. This was abandoned for want of funding, but in 2012 it was replaced by a listing of all entries with image and précis for each on the RHSV website. Two early concerns by the VCHA organisers have proved unfounded. The first, that professionals would dominate, has not occurred. Overwhelmingly, the prizes have gone to non-professionals, and when professionals have won, there has usually been a strong dimension, community dimension, as in Peter Yule's, the Royal Children's Hospital, and Andrew Brown May and Shirley Swain's, the Encyclopaedia of Melbourne. In some cases, professionals have cooperated with community groups, as was the case with Associate Professor Adrian Jones, who worked with Essendon Primary School to produce the school history Follow the Gleam, which won the print section in 2001. The second concern, that metropolitan contestants with easy access to major libraries and archives would monopolise the competition, overlooked the dauntless spirit of regional groups, who this year carried away six of the nine prizes. The effect of the VCHA over 14 years has been the stimulation of community history, the lifting of standards, and the fostering of diversity and originality. The judges continue to see chronology, scissors and paste, the whitewashing of local luminaries, and the airbrushing of inconvenient facts. But this year, with 160 entries, the standard was very high, and as a foretaste of the future, multimedia was far stronger than ever before. The competition encouraged multimedia long before the use of websites and phone apps for history purposes. In fact, the overall winner in 2001 was Warwick Lawrence for his CD-ROM 1864, which used interactive software to enable the viewer to experience part of Collins Street in that year. Similarly, the competition connected with schools long before the introduction of the Young Historians Award in 2012. This was evident in the work of teacher Graham Massey and Warwick Nabil Secondary College students who twice won prizes in the research category for their documentary books Fallen Heroes and Gallipoli Heroes. The judges have been astonished by the dazzling diversity and originality of entries in the competition, and I would like to give a few examples. In the print section, John Perry's book, The Quick and the Dead, Stahl and Its Race Through Time, explored the mythological and metaphysical dimensions of the Stahl gift. The China Woman, the book of Ken Olders, a criminal lawyer, was history in the form of a murder thriller, a suspenseful page-turner. In the exhibition section, Raylene Marshall, curator of the Living Museum of the West, produced A Stone Upon a Stone, a touring exhibition about the history and heritage of dry stone walls. Supported by 11 municipalities, this exhibition consisted of 24 narrative silk panels, which explored the distinctive work of Anglo-Celtic, Swiss-Italian and German workmen. One of the most striking walks was the Bayside City Council's Coastal Art Trail, Stage 3, which featured prints on signboards of the work of Australian artists who painted the coast from Brighton to Beaumaris. A standout entry in multimedia was Visions of Port Phillip, The Burrows of Arthur's Seat. This DVD, skillfully organised in 14 chapters, was a textured tapestry of family stories and social documentaries. In 2011, the judge's special prize for excellence went to Greg Eccleston for an enormous map based on great scholarship showing the routes of navigators, of early navigators of Bass Strait, 1770 to 1803. The most unusual entry, which captured the overall prize in 2004, was Oriental Crossing, a footbridge over Morses Creek at Wandilagong. Panels at either end of the bridge told of the conflict between Europeans and Chinese in the northeast during the Gold Rush days. The bridge was replete with the symbolism of reconciliation. As John Lay wrote, the bridge spans much more than a space. It spans a century and more of misunderstanding. The History Awards showcased diversity and originality, but the competition itself has challenged convention. A routine view of the value of local history is as a window on the national story. Thus, Gillian Durance's Still Going Strong, the story of the Moyara Honour Roll, which pursues the experiences of young soldiers from Moyara near Currumburra during and after the First World War, is correctly described as a microcosm of a much larger picture. It won the overall prize in 2007. However, the converse is also the case. Former federal government minister Neil Blewett recently wrote that for the gifted historian Tony Judd, the historian's task is to tell it as it is, to defend the little truths against the claims of grand narratives and the demands of the national story. Local history has its own standalone justification as defendant of the little truths and as the treasured interpretative record of local communities and for giving people a sense of belonging and historical perspective. Thus, Gillian Durance's book welded together a little community to restore and reflect on the local honour board. Anne Sinan, a critical care nurse, won the overall prize in 2003 for We Came With Nothing, Story of the West Sale Migrant Holding Centre, which revives the experiences of post-war displaced persons, many of whom came from the Baltic countries. Clearly the book is part of Australian immigration history, but it is also self-contained. Its publication and prize was celebrated by the immigrant community in Sale, who contributed the evocative box brownie photos and wanted their story told before they passed away. The VCHA has little patience with the oft-expressed view that only violent events give rise to interesting history. Although some entries have dealt with war and other turbulent events, many have focused on non-violent topics and demonstrated that these can be compelling history. Gillian Upton's The George, St Kilda Life and Times, winner of the overall prize in 2002, cleverly presents a landmark hotel as a mirror of the fortunes of the surrounding suburb. A German church in the Garden of God, Melbourne's Trinity Lutheran Church, 1853 to 2003, was a well-written and sumptuously illustrated book that involved a whole church community. Jenny Davies' popular book on Flinders Street Station claimed the overall prize in 2010, and Marie Coote won with her perceptive and original The Art of Being Melbourne this year. Among the multimedia crop of excellent entries on peaceful topics in 2012 were Wiperfield 100, A Traverse in Time, about the transformation of a relatively barren district into a national park, and Ray Brown's splendid interactive website on the stained glass firm of Ferguson and Urey. Widespread interest in community history is reflected in the VCHA contrasts curiously with the decline in academic research and teaching that focuses on the history of Victoria. The History Awards are the flag bearer of community history, but they are buttressed by the local history grants of the Public Record Office Victoria, which this year received 400 applications. They are also strongly supported by the RHSV, particularly book reviews by Don Gibb and Lenore Frost's work with local historical societies. Spurred on by the History Awards and digital technology, community historians are increasingly breaking the barricades, bypassing the traditional gatekeepers of published scholarship, and presenting their research in self-published books on DVDs, websites, and phone apps. There is a sense of unlimited possibilities. After many years of involvement with the History Awards, my conclusion, which I can duly document, is that Victorians are having an irrepressible love affair with community history.
There are so many coincidences and synergies over these 2 days, and I have to share with you just the coincidence that I was at Brighton State School in the 1960s as a school child, and I was at Brighton High School in the 1970s. And I had two stints of doing local history assignments, and Weston's book was passed across the desks and placed before us by our teachers back then. I don't know whether that's been part of it, but I still now do live in Brighton, and I would like you to know I moved out when I couldn't afford to be. I'm now in a little one-of-a-pair 1920s house in Mayrose Crescent. I am a member of the Brighton Residents for Urban Protection. I have protested with you. I am with you, John Lack, about all the six-car basement cinema complex houses. And I'd like you to know that I organise the signs in my street. I'm that strange woman who has a "We will oppose inappropriate development" signs in Mayrose Crescent. And the people in the two neighbouring streets of Edrow and Binney know that it's me that they can come to and hire signs as well. But Buxton's and Hodges know the troublemakers in Mayrose Crescent. So I'd just like to share that with you. So teachers. Thank goodness I had good teachers at primary and secondary school. I also had some wonderful ones at Melbourne University. And I am blessed in my life to have had Geoffrey Blaney, Lloyd Robson and John Lack looking after me in Australian history. I'll also throw in a mention for Antonio Sigona in classics and archaeology, who is still at Melbourne University. So teachers, I've been asked to speak for 15 minutes on the teaching of local history in Victorian schools. So 15 minutes, what can I do? How much could I cover? And how could I compete with the luminaries before me? So I thought, right, I'm going to go off and do something quite different. And by the way, thanks for the mention about the commendation, because I'll be commended with Graham Davison any time in those awards. That was very special. So I've decided I will do something different, and rather I will present to you how Australian history, Victorian history and local history is, can and should be taught by history teacher specialists, in particular in secondary schools. And I've decided to put you through an activity that I put my student teachers through. So I am the president of the History Teachers Association of Victoria. But my main job and the greatest joy in my life is training the next generation of history teacher specialists. This year I had over 100 at Monash University in the Faculty of Education, and they will find jobs, and that is largely because they will promote themselves as being history specialists with a BA and a major or a minor in history, or some really profound, demonstrable, recreational interest that they were able to use to pursue people that, hey, they should be in a history method. So the little activities, here you go. I'm going to say a few words to you, and if you were my students, I would ask you to write down your responses, but let's just have you think your responses and keep them in your minds. I want you to think of the first emotional response when you hear these two words, Australian history. Okay, what are the first three topics that come to mind when you hear Australian history? Next, what is your emotional response when you hear the words Victoria's history? And finally, what are the first three topics that come to mind when you hear Victoria's history? Now, I realise I'm preaching to the converted here, but this is what I do with my student teachers. So I'm going to leave you with your responses, remember them, and just hold on to them for a few moments. Now, in 2003, I was taking a group of my best history student teachers on what we used to call the History Teaching Fellowship in Canberra, where they were exposed to the National Historical and Cultural Institutions. And at the National Film and Sound Archive, I bought a $5 in the bargain bin DVD. And I bought it in the bargain bin. It's called That Certain Something, A Glorious Whirl of Australian Girls. And it's actually a World War II positive sort of DVD of a film that was made during World War II to lift morale. So I actually bought it because I thought, okay, I'll go take it home, enjoy it, $5, can't lose there. And we'll enjoy seeing what sort of activities and messages and how women were portrayed to boost morale during World War II in Australia. However, on my first screening at home, I realised that I had a really spectacular educational resource here. Indeed, it's not the film, it's the nearly 5 minutes of advertisement for the National Film and Sound Archives that precedes the actual film. So I'm going to show you, and I'm not going to say anything more, we're just going to look now at an advertisement that was made in 2001, highlighting the collection of the National Film and Sound Archive. And remember, I have asked you for some responses and topics with regard to Australian and Victorian history.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know.
We've made up a nationwide network of 54 stations by armed forces from the beginning of the world through Radio Australia.
As I looked around the room, you were all fully engaged with what you were looking at. In fact, I really didn't see anyone look aside with disinterest at any one point. Why were you so engaged? So, in fact, I'm going to start asking you a few questions that I would ask my student teachers at this point. So just a few quick responses from the floor. Why were you so fascinated and why was your attention held by that particular advertisement? Okay, so we can identify with a lot of perhaps the people, the places, themes, events. What else? A picture is worth a thousand words. So we've got really rich visuals and there's quite a reasonable pace to them to keep our interest moving. Someone over here was saying something. Yes, please.
It didn't shy away from some of the painful things in Australia.
Okay, so there was a sense of balance, of the not just, you know, a glorification of Australian history, but to, it does represent some of the darker sides, yes?
Particularly more.
Ah, very good. Kept you wanting to see more and know more.
Depends very much on what you know, how old you are, and what you recognise.
Ah, yes, that would, and I'm sure some of us here would definitely recognise more than, definitely more than most, for example, Year 9 students, but also there are clear people, places and events that even Year 9 students, who may not have had the rich exposure to history that we have, could still identify with. I've also noted in my notes, I'll just keep moving, that there is humour in it, there is the tragedy, there is also the strong voiceover, the radio broadcasts, the different music from the archive as well. And what were some of the topics shown?
Overemphasis on war.
An overemphasis on war.
There were a lot of
suburbs were missing.
Okay, so the suburbs were missing. This is from the National Collection. We have an overemphasis on... Okay, so there's some art missing or not missing. So
in,
okay, so there's some emphasis on sport. Is there a gender imbalance? Now, see, isn't this interesting what the historians start doing? They start finding what's missing rather than what's in. So let me just tell you some of the answers my students usually give, and may I say they do very swiftly. In fact, I have to stop them from telling me what's not in it before they identify what is in it. So there are events, specific and general, people, as in the everyday and famous individuals, groups, peoples and different cultures within Australia and beyond, and then there's usually a heated debate on whether multicultural or Indigenous are or are not represented well. There are places that are natural as well as human-made within Australia and overseas, and we see glimpses of England, Egypt, France, Belgium, the Asia-Pacific and Vietnam. There are icons, people, items or places. There are the areas of agriculture, industry, mining, transport and inventions. There are entertainments, the sport, recreation, dancing, films, music. There are also what are called curriculum perspectives. There are the different perspectives of gender, Indigenous, multicultural, global, technological and environmental. Another thing too is that the collection, and it's based only on what the National Archive holds, the film, the advertisement actually develops with something of a logical chronology. So I then ask the student teachers what they would do with that advertisement. If I told them, okay, you've got to formulate a lesson, this is, you're going into the lesson, this is all you have, what questions and activities would you get your students to do? Now, I've been told I've got 15 minutes, so I'm probably already using that up, so I'll spare you the questions and answers, but you have a think. What would you as teachers do with that footage? So the sorts of responses we usually discuss are that students would ask, or the student teachers would ask their students, how many individuals do you know? How many places do you know? Who or what is missing or underrepresented? And of course, students may then say, oh, well, we do know who Cathy Freeman is, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the war scenes. And so a good teacher would possibly then give the student this as an impetus to investigating in some more detail about the people, place or event. A good teacher would then help students devise the questions that they will use to frame their research. And now even a lot of good teachers would ask, if you were making such a film in 2012, what images would you put in it to represent Australia today? What music would you put in the soundtrack? And the students and the student teachers would probably then go off and make such a film. The time has passed me by, but that is what many of them would do. So I then ask them, were there more topics with regard to Australian history in that footage than you thought of when I first asked you to think of topics? I'll leave that with you. Most of them nod yes, so there were aspects of Australian history that didn't come to mind. I then ask them to repeat the same for Victoria's history, and I see them think a little bit longer, and they think, oh yes, that, you know, that image and that type of history, yes, that's part of Victoria's history as well. I then remind them that everyone sitting and watching that advertisement was fully engaged, utterly fascinated, that not one eye had strained or moved aside. And so I say to them, I hope no one here, when I said, what is your emotional response to the two words of Australian history or Victoria's history, had an initial response of that it's boring. And to be honest, some of the students say, well, yes, I did say that. They say that in the lecture, or they say that in the tutes, or they come to me at the end of the year and say, oh, by the way, Rosalie, I did actually, you know, I did actually think it was boring. And this is where I put a little bit of passion and theatre into my lecture at that point. And I tell them, this is the only time I will tell them how they must think. And you as educators, in particular the tertiary educators here, know that you're not allowed to tell students how they must think. So this is all part of a theatre when I tell them that this is what they must think. I tell them that the moment they think for one moment that Victoria's history or Australia's history is boring, they are to immediately wipe that thought and think, how can they make it as fascinating as it is? I tell them that no history is boring. The teaching of it can be. And I tell them that as the next generation of history specialists, it is their responsibility with the young people with whom they are working to find the fascination and find the purpose. At that point, I remind them what we've done in some earlier lectures, and we've had several on lesson planning before that. And I'm not here to spout anyone else's research, but I will just say that one of the three things that I ask my student teachers to do when they plan their lessons, and they are expected to write formal lesson plans during their teacher preparation, I say to them, okay, in real world, you will not be writing formal lesson plans in a busy teaching day, but even if you're walking down the corridor, the bell has just gone, there are three things you must think before you walk, another must think. There are three things I would hope would inform your lesson planning, and that is that you are quite clear about the knowledge you are about to teach, the skills your students are going to develop, and they are not only, the history academic skills, the skills of our discipline, but they are the skills for life, the skills for other careers, the skills that help them make sense of the everyday, because we have to have a purpose with our students, our school students. Not all of them will go on to become historians. So what is the knowledge? What skills are you going to help your students develop? And in particular, big finale, what values, attitudes and behaviours are you going to explore through that historical content and through the skills that inform your lesson? And so I return to that dilemma about Victoria's history, and I should have said I've chosen Australia's history and Victoria's history to represent my definition of local history for today, but the Victorian one also embraces local community histories. We need to find what is relevant and what is purposeful. We as teachers can't just love history. It has to be made relevant to our students. So I take them back to the footage that we've just viewed, and I say, well, there were so many different people, faces, feelings, sources in different forms, the sounds, the rich visual images, and then, of course, the young generation can talk about so many other digital representations. To conclude, I then give them a page of all the history education providers that I'm aware of in Victoria that offer some sort of educational service. And the page of providers includes the names of museums, galleries, Royal Historical Society of Victoria, heritage centres. I encourage them to go to their local monuments in their communities, to their local historical society, and to visit the places of history. So it's not just learning from the web, it's not just learning from books, It's actually going to places and, where possible, actually handling artefacts. And I dispense at that point a suitcase full of promotional brochures that I've collected from all the museums and galleries, and I always trouble Kate for all the latest membership forms. And the three wonderful things that RHSV has produced in recent years, the laneways map, the timeline, and is it your regional, the regional little brochure? And for some of them, this is all a bit something a bit new. They haven't sort of thought of this wealth of, you know, rich resources all around them. One of their assessment tasks for them after this is to visit one of the places, and some of them do sneak in here just quietly and have a look around in the Royal, in the RHSV. Visit one of the places and submit an overview of the historical content that that venue deals with and its education offerings. They then have to come back, write a little report on the place they've been to, and write a lesson plan identifying the knowledge, skills, values, attitudes and behaviours that have been gleaned in terms of that exploration of Australian and or Victorian history. To conclude, local Victorian and Australian histories taught in such ways, as I've just shown you, by specialist history educators in schools are fascinating and purposeful. There are good bands of these teachers going out into schools, and my 100 or so will get jobs and they will be teaching history. I do have to put a little qualifier into my talk though, and this is when I returned to Brighton State School, Brighton High School. I was so fortunate to have had teachers, particularly at Brighton High, who had, as I stated earlier, a major or a minor in history, and had undertaken history method, and who knew and loved their stuff. Something happened in the 80s and 90s. Something happened. And somewhere along the line, that idea that only people who really know and love their history should be allowed and given the privilege to teach in the nation's classrooms, somewhere along the line, someone decided that it's okay for anyone with a vague humanities background, or, you know, the teaching of history is easy, just give a teacher the textbook, you know, that'll work. Somewhere along the line that happened. So whilst there are still very many wonderful things happening in schools, and as I said, the greatest joy for me at Monash is working with the young ones that are about to go out. If anyone in this audience would like to help, just as John and I are going to save Brighton, if anyone in this audience has any political clout with any of the major political parties and would like to, amongst all the legislation and all the documents and all the talk, state again that only those teachers that have an academic background or a demonstrable love for Australian and Victorian and local histories be allowed the privilege of teaching history to our children, well then, I'd really like to meet you, and I hope we can just remedy that little matter together. Thank you very much.
What I'm going to talk to you about, and to link to what's been discussed today, is I've moved a bit beyond the rate books, although I must confess that when I began working on Richmond, the first thing I did was go and work on the rate books and reconstruct Mary Street, and that became my iconic street for understanding what had happened in Richmond, and because it's got a affluent early end and a very poor end at the other end. I've moved into a new area because I think we've tended to run ourselves down a bit in this country, saying, oh, we don't have a census return, so all thrown out, isn't that terrible? But we actually have two sources which are unique. In a sense, almost unique. Well, one is unique, the other is almost unique. The almost unique one resides in Victoria, because one of the great people who came in that rush of talent in the Gold Rush generation was a man called William Henry Archer, who was set up the first recording of birth, deaths and marriages. Now, not only was he given a free hand, but he was a disciple of Dr. William Farr in England, who'd been who was the man who constructed the whole registration of birth, deaths and marriages and the census and the development of life tables for actuarial analysis, the analysis of birth, of death for health, and was the one of the great figures in statistics and human measurement. Archer was his disciple, and there'd been a meeting internationally of how would be the gold standard in how to implement the registration of vital events in a society. And Archer Fire was not able to realise that in the United Kingdom. They began registering them in 1837, and the registration was never to the standard that he wished. The only person who put the full Fire program into effect was William Henry Archer in Victoria. And so that our death certificates in particular are probably, from the 19th century ones, the best in the world. And they, what was remarkable was first that they had a nosology of causes of death that were scientifically sound for the period. Secondly, that every death certificate had to be signed off by a medical practitioner. Thirdly, full information on birth, marriages and death certificates were recorded about the demographic setting of that individual, of their families, of their previous marriages, of their children, who was alive, who was dead. You're used to this. It's extraordinary and special and quite different. And so what we have is, instead of the census, is these amazing documents, if you can do find documents cradle to grave for an individual, which document a life in a way that really you cannot do in the United States, you can't do in Canada, and you can sort of do in England, but with none of, not anywhere near the same sort of detail. The other extraordinary records are unique, and they're the convict records. And in particular, the convict records of Tasmania, which were known, have been called a paper panopticon, because Tasmania was essentially an open prison which had special nasty places for people who re-offended and were a problem. And the whole enterprise was managed by this highly developed bureaucracy that watched and observed everything that was happening to every convict wherever they were. So in a conduct record, you'll see lots of events which takes time to interpret, and they're underlined with a date. And that means that every time a convict did something that needed to be examined, judged and maybe punished, that went before a magistrate. At the end of each week, the police magistrates from all over the Van Diemen's Land would send the reports in to the convict department, and the clerks would write them up in the conduct record. Secondly, the description of the convict body is the most detail we have of 19th century bodies. No other country in the world has a settler or immigrant population described physically in the way that convicts were described, because if they ran away, they didn't have fingerprints or photographs. They had to know where every scar was, where every pimple was, where every tattoo. Very bad career move if you're in crime to have tattoos. So there they have we are the only country in the world that knows the eye colour of a large proportion of our founding people. We have an extraordinary amount of information about their families, because the convict on arrival, when they took the indent and they were stripped and measured, and then they were asked a whole series of questions about their crime, what was their account of it, about their family, who they left behind, how many children were there in their family, what did their parents do, where did they come from, what was their story, and these are written in the indent. And often you can hear the convict's voice. I mean, there's one famous one, I probably won't get it quite right, but it's, I was travelling in a circus with a one-legged woman and a talking dog. You have these extraordinary moments of ordinary literate people coming through. And then we follow them, and they're put through a stress regime where it's like a game of snakes and ladders or Monopoly, there are rewards if you behave, and if you behave you can get out early. And so there are all sorts of incentives to modify your behaviour. At the same time, you are being confined, humiliated, made to do appallingly difficult, hard work, except that you are being fed, if you're a man, 4,500 calories a day. Now, 1,500 calories a day is the minimum that you need to live on. It's when you get under 1,500 calories a day and you're pregnant that the fetus begins to suffer. So 4,500 calories a day is a huge ration for men doing physical work. They didn't always get it because there was all sorts of corruption and the food was often nicked, sold off and so on, black market. But everything that's happening to you is being observed. And so what we have is a record of a body and a person and a personality undergoing a stress regime where it's a great test of their self-control, their intelligence, their temperament, and their ability to avoid trouble. And so the smart ones never get into trouble. Now, what Founders and Survivors is trying to do is to find out what happened to the convicts, because we actually don't know very much. We know about special people. We know about outstanding people. We know about interesting stories. But at a population level, we have actually no idea how many survived their experience well, how many went on to build a new life, how many were wrecked thereafter, how many got married. And so the idea of this study is to try and get some handle on those issues. And these are some of the people. I'm going to zip through this because we've only got a short amount of time, but this is the scale of the operation. Over between the ARC and the Australian National Data Service, we've now been given about $1.8 million. What we do is what we call prosopographical demography. So prosopography, which many you'll be familiar with, is mass biographies, trying to put together a portrait of a group of people, a community, an elite, whatever, by having lots of biographies and then trying to make sense of what do these people share, where do they come from. And so we're doing this doing a demographic study looking at birth, death and marriage and outcomes of lives and health, but also enriched by much more historical detail. And very quickly, our aims are to study the convicts transported to Van Diemen's Land as a population rather than simply as individuals or groups, to trace their lives after sentence, ending with a death registration and causes of death, to reconstitute an intergenerational data set of their descendants, and finish with those that served in the First World War, where their grandsons or great-grandsons and occasionally sons, in fact, underwent a very similar experience through a stress regime that recorded their reactions to the terrible things that happened to them. And a lot of the conduct, offences and reactions are very similar to the conduct convict records. To study convicts under sentence with soldiers within the IAF as two related populations, and to study the effects of characteristics and exposures in early life on health and resilience under stress. So we're looking at what gives people strength and resilience, what makes them more frail, is to use the technical term, what are the sources of frailty, and so on. And so what really happened to them after they left the penal system? Where did they go? How many stayed in Tasmania or went home or went elsewhere? And where this becomes relevant to our considerations today is we've discovered that 30,000 of them came to Victoria. Quite a lot went back again because it was an excursion during the gold rush, but the hidden history of Victoria is a history also of the emancipists who came here. And one of the remarkable things in James Boyce's brilliant book on 1835 is to start telling us and teaching us to look again at the first 10 years of the settlement, the European settlement, which is one where it's really emancipists who are doing the hard work. It's emancipists who are making this new colony. And they've been hidden from view. They didn't go around advertising the fact that they had a convict past. They had to do everything to try and conceal it. But this is a whole new story in Victoria. What were the characteristics of those who became founders? What's special about those who succeeded in establishing a family that went on to have descendants? Were they different from those who could not or would not make a new life? And what can we learn about the impact of severe stress on lifelong health? How long do they live? What did they die from? How robust were their families? very quickly, we have a website, which if you've, any of you have got convict ancestors, I want you to immediately get onto our website and put them in if we don't have them already, because the only way we're going to find most of those who came to Victoria is by through their descendants, because one of the major things they did was change their names. We have a newsletter which comes out 3 times a year, it's online, and this is building our community. And these are one of the examples of the sorts of records that we've had to turn into a text which can be then read by computers and analysed. And so this is a typical conduct record. And this is what we've been able to turn those records into, where it's much easier for people to be able to read. And this is a lady called Bess Ward, who was transported at the age of 15 from Northern Ireland. And she... it's her conduct record. She wasn't too bad a girl while she was in the system, but she had a tendency for having a foul mouth and getting drunk. But she ended up in Castlemaine. I have learned to say Castlemaine, by the way, during this project after a lot of nagging from people. She ends up with a criminal career, continuing in Victoria. She married a man, another convict in Tasmania. They had a very large family. The family ended up in Campbell's Creek. Two daughters married into the Chinese mining community. This is a family that survived, despite Mum, who's a real problem and continues drinking and fighting and getting and being very difficult and stealing things. The latest thing we found as they digitised more papers is that her youngest daughter, who was probably actually the daughter of her second oldest daughter, because she looked very Chinese, and she shouldn't have looked Chinese because her father was not Chinese, also had a baby at 15, and Mum got into trouble because when she gave birth on the floor, her mother didn't pick up the baby for about 3 or 4 hours. And the baby died, and the coronial inquiry found that the baby was born a good size and well and should have survived. Now, what Mum's doing is old-fashioned birth control, which is if a baby's not wanted, you did all your best to make sure that baby passed away, which is something we found happening with the babies that were born at the women's hospital to unmarried mothers, and it was only the Infant Life Protection Act of 1893 onwards that really began to clean up that, which was that in past and still in very poor countries, babies that don't have a future, it's perhaps for the best, as they would have said, if they should fade away. And this is her grandson, who's actually the son of that youngest daughter, who was probably actually her granddaughter, having in the army, and his descendants still in Campbell Creek. Now, to be able to do all this research, we couldn't possibly do it, even with $1.8 million. That just pays for running the thing and for doing all the digital work. What we've needed is citizen historians. And so the thing which has been really exciting is that we've now really got about 70 people who are working online for us, following and tracing the people on a ship. So they're following a whole voyage, which is convicts have shared an experience. They come often from a common origin. They share the experience on the ship. They become identified, as did all free immigrants, for the rest of their time in the colonies by the ship on which they arrived. And so these volunteers are working online. They're doing genealogy in tracing, and we give them an ancestry subscription, and they're tracing what happened to the family, but also trying to look through the historical things. And we give them various tools, and these are some of the ships that are being done. And this is a sort of spreadsheet that all these wonderful people are filling out. And what we're going to be able to do is to drill down to the actual birthplace of convicts. In the past, people have looked at where they came from by the county in which they were convicted, but that's just the county capital where the assizes were. So now we can now drill down to the difference between people who come from a rural village to an industry-type town to those who come from big port cities, and they are quite distinct populations. who behave differently in the system and have different outcomes in their lives afterwards. So this is the sort of work that people are doing. I just mentioned there that we have to make sure we correct the names, because when the indent was taken, the convict clerk would write down from what the convict said, and one of the women gave a birthplace as Oban, O-B-O-N, England. Now, we all know Oban is in Scotland. It's just down the road from where the McCalmans come from. And someone got very puzzled about this, but she was down at Oban. Well, of course, where she came from was London, and she'd said, when asked, where are you born? Oban. Hi, Hoban. So you get wonderful, but for once praise Google, its algorithms are so clever that if you put in these phonetic accounts of these place names and the county, it very usually comes up with the right one. Just to give you some idea of causes of death, senile decay, you can't read it anyway, so that's no point. One of the things that... Here's a group of women coming late from Ireland after the famine. They're not very criminal if they've come after the famine. All of those of you who are passionate Irish historians, we have shown that the Irish were persecuted and treated unfairly compared to everyone else. Seriously, the Irish courts were anxious to get rid of anyone who was a pest. And so the Irish convicts, particularly after the famine, are much less likely to actually be criminals. They're people who've stolen food, they're people who've done things deliberately in order to get transported. And what we can see in the indents is what's happened to the family structures that they've left behind. So there's a sister in America, there are no parents left, there's a brother in the army. Whereas the families before the famine, there are 14 brothers and sisters. And so these would be one of the few accounts that exist in the world of the structure of Irish families. And there's a huge project to be done using the convict records to look at the impact of the famine on Irish families. But as you can see, not many of them had children, and if they do have children, they don't have very many. And this is finally some software that we're developing with money from the Australian National Data Service, which will enable us, and will be open source, and people will be able to feed in family trees, which will then it turns into populations and gets rid of all the duplicates. That means we can understand demographically. Now, this is what maybe gives great potential, because as you all know, family history is growing even faster than local history. And when I began this project, people said to me, oh, look, you'll find the family historians are fairly hopeless. They're only interested in themselves. That's not true. People, having found their family history and have got the bug, and they're hooked on history, and I do think one of our problems in teaching history is that it's one of those things that people grow into. That when you're young, you don't, unless you're weird like most of us were, you don't have the sort of imagination or interest to feel that the past is important to you. But as you get older, it does become important. And so people discover history, and if I had a sixpence for all the time that people have said to me, I hated history at school but now I love it, I'd be a rich woman. So what we're finding is there's this enormous range of citizen historians who are extraordinarily naturally skillful. In fact, often our very best researchers have had no academic background whatsoever. Sometimes that's often an impediment. It's particularly people who are used to working with spreadsheets, who are used to working with detail, who are exceptionally good, and they are... Now, I've got one man, Broadford, who's a draftsman. Now, if I had students who could write like he does, my life would be... Because he just knows how to write a history account. It's just there, it's just sitting, and he's just done some most wonderful work. One of the things he did and initiated how to do it was to check through the Victorian Pioneer Index everybody who had a Tasmanian birthplace, because that then gave us a clue to find a family that had come from Tasmania, and he reconstructed those families and found extraordinary families who left no descendants and who have got no one to remember them. So very quickly, what What is all this going to tell us about what's been happening? What are we learning? First of all, I think what we've had confirmed is that the history most of us do is the history of winners. And the winners are people who leave descendants to remember them. And one of the shocking things about Australian history is that an experiment such as this, to set up a settler colony, we know the damage and casualty rate of the Aboriginal population was catastrophic, but there was also a hidden catastrophic loss rate amongst the settlers. First, for convicts, because there weren't enough women for them to marry, so that, and at one stage there were 7 men to every woman in Tasmania. Secondly, convict women were, by the time they married, old. Many of them had been on the town, they'd had venereal disease, they weren't very fertile, they initially had drinking problems. So they did not many had big families. They'd have to marry very young, soon after arrival, be assigned to their husbands, so they actually escaped the convict system to be the mothers of the nation. The convict men themselves were going to find it very difficult to make a living in the new economy. They came out of the convict system destitute. Most of them died destitute. We think probably the proportion, the number of men who have left descendants is under 10,000 out of 63,000 men. Sorry, 53,000 men. A very large number of these families have one generation that don't reproduce a third generation. The people who we hear about, the stories, the remarkable ones, are remarkable. And one of the things that many of the people working on our ships have been is working on the ships that brought their ancestors, and they now see their ancestors in a very different light, that they were exceptional, they were different. People who are able to survive the system are much less likely to have a rich conduct record, for instance. They probably were smarter. They needed certain sets of skills. If you had very good agricultural or particularly horticultural skills, you could prosper. Some lucky convicts were the first to get gold in the gold rush. And so those people that everyone deplored, who charged around town in carriages with girls showing off gold rings and big fat ankles and quaffing champagne and lighting cigars with £5 notes, some of those were former convicts. The convicts were here. They knew about how to live rough. They were smart in the bush, so therefore they were the ones to get the alluvial gold first off. We have no idea how many did, but we can certainly see cases, and we can see that people suddenly do die with money. Where else did they get it, or where else did they buy land? What we also now know is that the convicts did not live as long as the rest of the population. That for women, the penalty of convict servitude was up to 10 years in lost life expectancy, and that Irish and men and women lived less long than other convicts. We've looked at the swing rioters who were political prisoners and who didn't spend long in the system as a control group, who are not really criminal, who have skills that the colonial economy needed, and their life outcomes are very similar to free immigrants. So we've got a control group, and we can see that our people are different. It is in many ways a very sad story of alcoholism, of domestic violence. These are people who've been very badly damaged, but people like that don't leave descendants. They don't leave families that are able to survive and continue. Many of the convict lines come only through daughters, because daughters could find a husband, and if they were pretty, perhaps a good one. But boys had to actually make a living, and they've got no skills, they've got no reputation, and so on. So what do we find in Victoria? We find that we've got various collectivities of convicts and that they did stick together. The Ballarat Historical Society has wonderful resources, but one of the things that's absolutely missing from their extensive lists and things on their webpage are anything to do with convicts, and yet Ballarat East is the convict capital of rural Victoria. I've once got a death certificate with 5 deaths on it, and 3 of them were convicts. convicts die in huge numbers in the benevolent asylum. So we've been looking at those pick-up deaths of those who didn't have families. They live in Ashby in Geelong. They collect all round the gold rushes. In the city of Melbourne, over the suburbs where they mostly die, is Collingwood, and that actually means they've probably got a house. They overwhelmingly die in hospitals because they're for the destitute. In the city of Melbourne, they live in the inner city. We have some in Brighton, where they usually were gardeners or had horses or hawkers. The sorts of people who came to Melbourne were more likely to have been from London or Liverpool, but particularly from London, because the economy they understood was the economy of grafting, of hawking, of pickpockets. They had no place. They couldn't make a living in Van Diemen's Land, but they certainly knew how to operate in Melbourne. The ones who do well are often horticulturalists. And there's another group who do well who've been high-class servants, and they're people who know how to talk to the upper classes, and they're often quite smart in business. So the whole convict experiment is one of a small group of exceptional people leaving a mark and staying. And this large number of sad, broken people who die, and it's in response to that particularly the Australian colonial governments continued the tradition set, or the institutions established by having a convict system in the first place, of in fact strong centralised ideas about bringing the parish welfare system, but doing it at a colonial state level. And so we need to sort of think back at this, what people brought with them in their heads, and their expectations of what we now understand to have actually been a welfare state that existed in Britain since the Elizabethan Poor Law. Nasty as it was, certainly badly have changed and made terrible by the reform of the poor laws in the 1830s, but nonetheless for country people, a system that was still operating right into the 1880s. And how they try and replicate that, particularly in Victoria, with benevolent asylums, with voluntary hospitals in the goldfields, and so on. And so there's a whole different society there, which we've perhaps not plugged into, and we can only find in this grassroots microhistory and family history. I want to finish with a story of Samuel Phillips, who was transported for 14 years for poaching, and poachers are an interesting subgroup, Northamptonshire. He did his time quietly in Tasmania, his 14 years, and he had one offence, which was trying to defend someone else. He'd left behind at the age of 24 another young woman who was pregnant with their child. He and she were illiterate. He did his 14 years time. He spent about 8 years in Tasmania, and then 1852 he came to Melbourne. 9 months later, we see him on a ship to Liverpool. 6 weeks after he arrived in Liverpool, he returned to Northamptonshire to Corby, where he had come from, which just had a by-election which the Labour Party won with a swing of 12% yesterday. And in the Corby Church, there were two church services. The first was that he married Susan Patrick after having been away from her for 24 years. The second was that they christened the grandchild that was born to the child she was carrying. But there is more. Because he had on him a very large amount of money. And he went and bought a very good farm, which it was on land newly released by the Queen's Domain, the Royal Domain, next to the Duke of Grafton, which is the old so-and-so who'd had him convicted in the first place. This was very well chosen land. He built a lovely stone house. The family still lives there and still farms. I think he found something on the goldfields.